was done with Alvaro Mosota, who some of you will know, who was here as a Psi student last year. This was actually the most important insight here is actually due to him as part of his Psi project. Some references for this are the archive paper that we wrote together, which is, you'll see, a slightly different treatment than what I'll be doing, a little more along traditional lines. And also three lectures that I delivered in Bengaluru, as it's now called, at the ICTS. I don't know if they're actually online. I mean, they were supposed to be online, but I haven't checked, and I don't have the URL for it. But there'll be a more extensive, it was a lecture series at a school, and so much more details are given there. And then the last reference that I've listed here is a paper by Matt Liefer, who seemed to be thinking along very similar lines several years ago. I can't tell exactly how much there is in common, but there's definitely something in common there. So let me begin by just reading out the abstract that summarizes what the talk is about. So when utilized appropriately, the path integral offers an alternative to the ordinary quantum formalism of state vectors, self-adjoint operators, and external observers, an alternative that seems closer to the underlying reality and more in tune with quantum gravity. The basic dynamical relationships are then expressed, this is the key point, not by a propagator, which is what you're used to thinking of a path integral as giving to you, but by the quantum measure, which is a set function, in other words, a function that assigns a number to a set of histories, and it assigns to every set E of histories its generalized measure as given by the path integral. The idea here is that just as Brownian motion, as an example of a stochastic dynamics, is described, has its dynamics described by the Wiener measure, the probability measure that tells you the probabilities of any event that you like happening with the Brownian particle, that in the same way, this generalized quantum measure should be giving us the dynamic, the quantum dynamics. However, there's a big difference. It's not a probability measure, and except in some special cases, it cannot be interpreted as a probability, since, first of all, it's not additive, and second of all, it's not bounded above by one. It can exceed one. Nor can the quantum measure in general be interpreted as the expectation value of a projection operator or a POVM. Nevertheless, it can be given a more or less direct experimental meaning. This is the new development or the new result, which, and I will describe how one can ascertain the value for any event E, mu of E, experimentally by means of an arrangement which in a certain sense acts as an E pass filter. And then I may comment a little, this raises the question whether in certain circumstances we can claim that when we get a positive result from this quote unquote measurement, we can say that the event E actually did occur. So that's kind of the summary. I stress here that the key, aside from the measure itself, the key concept is that of event, which is a set of histories. So I'm using the word event in that same sense that it's used in probability theories, theories of stochastic processes, but not in the sense that it's a point of space-time, which is a perennial confusion that comes up. Point of space-time, you might think of it as an event too, but it's a very specialized kind of event from this point of view. And of course, we won't be doing quantum gravity. We'll be doing a different system, which I'll describe, which I call the two-site hopper, and which I'll describe in a second. So let me give a little bit more background and motivation for this point of view that I'm be working with. Some of this, to some of you here, this will be familiar. That is, it'll be familiar to you that this is my point of view, but let me nevertheless try to introduce it once more. the whole point of what I'm doing is within a broader program, which is to recast quantum mechanics as a theory of histories, or histories-based theory, as I've called it here. Now, why would we want to do this? Well, one reason, one thing that's behind all this is the relation to quantum gravity, which to my mind is not only an important thing to have in mind when one is thinking of quantum foundations, but would be the ultimate test in some sense of any quantum foundational theory or scheme, let's say, because whether or not that scheme is fruitful and leads to a new physics in quantum gravity would be, in some ways, a real test of it, I think. So let me say a little bit about the relationship between quantum foundations and quantum gravity. Arguably, quantum foundations has something to offer to quantum gravity. I believe that. I put here a question mark because I can't make the case airtight, but I think that arguably quantum gravity needs quantum foundations. Two or three of these, here are three reasons. Two of them are familiar. One is that in quantum mechanics, in the case of the usual interpretations, it rests on the behavior of external agents. Certainly the operational paradigm does. But in the case of quantum gravity, and most especially in the case of quantum cosmology, there are no external agents. By the same token, in those kind of examples, there are no experimental tests that we can do that are under our control. We don't control. Most of the evidence from quantum gravity, where it's relevant, is going to be say, in the early universe, in regimes where there were no observers, and we certainly have no control over the initial conditions for the early universe. And then there's a third reason. All this points to needing a way of thinking about quantum mechanics that's free of those things. And then there's a third reason, which is specific to causal sets, which is in causal sets, there's a kind of dynamical scheme called sequential growth. And in its classical version, a causality condition called quantum Bell causality plays an important role. One hope that we've had for a while is that if we can understand relativistic causality better in the quantum case, this will lead us to an appropriate quantum generalization of this classical dynamics for causal sets. But in order to do that, we have to understand relativistic causality better and in a way that's not based on no signaling or some sort of condition that involves these external agents and tests under our control. So these are reasons why quantum foundations has something to offer to quantum gravity. Conversely, I think it's even clearer that quantum gravity has something to offer to quantum foundations. I noticed here that there have not been over the years a lot of people necessarily agreeing with me on this, or at least not acting in such a way that is inspired by any such agreement. But nevertheless, I would claim that what quantum gravity has to offer to quantum foundations is the fact that it requires a path integral kind or a histories-based formulation. I won't go into the reasons for that, but I'll just give an example. If you think what it means to define a black hole horizon in another way of thinking about space-time than in terms of the space-time itself, say in terms of initial data, Cauchy data, I think you'll quickly appreciate why that's a non-starter, or let's say an almost hopeless technical task to think about a black hole horizon in that way. Horizon is a property of the global space-time, and ultimately all relativistic properties are global properties because we have no God-given coordinates for the space-time. We can't talk about what's happening at just one point. So my lesson from this, there's at least one other person here, Lucian, who was thinking also that quantum gravity has something to offer to quantum foundations, but probably not quite along the same lines. But my lesson from this is that the path integral formulation is the one that quantum gravity needs. And this is yet another reason why we would like to, why we might like to reformulate quantum mechanics as a history-based theory. Now, the reason why this is a reason why this is a well, this is something that we can imagine doing, and that in some sense is even already done, is written here. Well, first I'm raising the question, can we do quantum mechanics with histories and nothing more? The reason why that's not a crazy enterprise is captured, first of all, in this following claim. All proper probabilities of all instrument events follow from and can be computed from the path integral alone. This is a claim I'm making. We'll see an example of it, but I'm not. It's in some sense inherent in this so-called ABL or Aharonov Bergmann-Leibowitz formula, if you're familiar with that. But anyway, it's something that's true. So given that, it's reasonable to ask, can we make a histories-based quantum mechanics? And this is the background for what I'm going to say, and I'll describe a little bit about how to do it. And we'll see along the way that this question will lead us to a new class of measurements. New class of measurements in the same sense, roughly, that weak measurements are a new class of measurements. So it's a new kind of measurement that could be done, and I think will be done in the near future, a measurement of that deals with events of a more general type than just instrument events, which is what the operationalist approach will lead to. Or another way to say it is, instead of events that have to do with configuration of some system at one moment of time, these will be events that are temporally extended in a sense that I'll explain. So let me start now by reviewing or introducing the whole discussion from here on will be in the context of one particular kind of simple quantum system, which I call the two-site hopper. But I think you'll be able to appreciate when you see what happens that there's nothing special about this. One could have done the same for any system that's sufficiently under control. The reason I say that is when it comes to things where time is continuous, it's harder to describe it in such discrete terms like I'm going to do here, but it's very, most people would assume, and I would assume too, that the continuum, say continuous time, is some sort of limit of this kind of situation. So this is the kind of situation that's typically considered in quantum information. So what I call two-site hopper is some sort of particle you can imagine that's living on a lattice of just two sites, right? And all it can do is, and time is also discrete in this, imaginary world, or maybe it's the real world, but anyway, time will be discrete. And so there's a discrete set of sequence of times, and at each time, the particle can either remain where it is or hop to the other site, and that's all that happens. So this is an optical model of that idea, which is produced by photon mirrors and beam splitters in a way that I think will look very familiar. So I've labeled here the beam 0 and 1 after each beam splitter in a convenient way. And so there's a source here, the photon comes along, it meets the beam splitter, either reflects or does it or transmits. And then depending on what it does, it emerges either in beam 1 or beam 0, and then again beam 0, and so on. So you can put any number of these beam splitters. The amplitude for the transmission at the beam splitter is 1 over the square root of 2, without loss of generality. And for reflection, it's I over the square root of 2. So a history then, of such a part, a history of such a particle's world line, if you like, is what's a history in this context, and it can be described, since we're just idealizing that we're leaving out details of what happens along the way in each of these beams, it can be described as just a sequence of bits, either 0, 0, 0, 0, which would be this one, right, or 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and so on. It always starts at zero, the way I've set it up. So I'll write a history. I'll use the symbol gamma for a history, often used for a world line, and then it'll always be of the form zero, and then the undetermined ones, x1, x2, x3, that vary from history to history. So I've told you what the amplitudes are. Now I have to tell you what you may not be so familiar with, which is what is the measure of the event E for such a system. So the history, first of all, for each history, gamma, which remember was just a sequence of bits, could be represented that way. History is just a pro its amplitude is just, sorry, to each such history, there's an amplitude, and that amplitude is just a product of the amplitudes that take place at each beam splitter. There's more amplitudes for transmission and propagation, but they're the same for all the histories and basically drop out, so I'll ignore them. So what's different is just what happens at the beam splitter, which way the photon goes. And so its history is then a product of amplitudes 1 over the square root of 2, or I over the square root of 2. Now the measure, now, so that's also familiar, but this may be less familiar. The given event, and remember an event, E, is an event by definition is a set of histories. We want to associate to each one a kind of generalized probability, which I'm calling the quantum measure, and it's defined this way. It's given, the path integral is, of course, a sum over histories. That's another one of its names. But in this case, it's a double sum over histories. So it's a sum over pairs of histories, gamma and gamma prime, which belong to the event E, of the amplitude of the one times the complex conjugate of the amplitude of the other times a number which is 0 or 1, which controls which histories can interfere. So if this is one, if theta of gamma and gamma prime is 1, it means those two histories can interfere and you get a contribution. If it's 0, it means they could not interfere and you get no contribution to this double sum. This rule may look a little, well, this rule may look a little unfamiliar, but if you think through, if you think it through, you may be able to relate it to something that you know and you're very familiar with, which is that histories are alternatives, as people sometimes say, which interfere. If you're dealing with those, you add the amplitudes first and then square the result. If you're dealing with alternatives that do not interfere, you square the amplitudes first and then add them. This is that whole thing rolled together into one ball of wax. Anyway, this is the definition of the quantum measure, and as I, at least in the case of a unitary theory, which is what we're dealing with here, this theta always takes a very simple form. It's one, it tells you that it's one when the two histories, gamma and gamma prime, that are its arguments, share the same final outcome. So they finally, at the end of all those beam splitters, the two photons emerge in the same beam. And the two photons, I mean, there's only one photon, but I mean the two trajectories of that photon, represented by gamma and gamma prime, merge in the same beam. Then they interfere. If they emerge in a different beam, then they don't interfere. So as I just stressed, the quantum measure, because it's a generalized probability, and because probabilities in quantum mechanics are squares of amplitudes, it takes the form of a double sum instead of a single sum. And although I didn't prove it, I claim that if you evaluate, I've already claimed it, that if you were to evaluate this for a more complicated setup that has instruments in it, which we'll see such an example, and then you compute the value of that quantum measure of particular instrument event E, like the pointer being this way or the pointer being this way, or it sending a signal to the data acquisition device or whatever, that's one way or another way, then if you compute, that's what I mean by an instrument event, and if you compute its quantum measure, it is precisely the Born rule probability of that event. In other words, it's the probability that the instrument will read that way in the experiment. Yeah.
The key stories have to start and end for this thing to make sense?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in the way I've set it up, I have said that there is a final outcome. They don't actually have to end, and I'll be saying something about that in a second. But you do, to write this formula down, this is a peculiarity of quantum mechanics, you do have to introduce a final moment of time to write the formula. But it turns out, and this is a consistency condition, really, for this formula, it turns out that if you move the final moment of time later, it doesn't change the measure of the event E. One can check that. It's basically, that consistency is guaranteed in the unitary case by unitarity. In more general cases, and there are non-unitary cases, it needs to be imposed as a condition, unless you really believe there is a final moment of time. But so, as I was just saying, quantum mechanics is then defined by a double sum. This double sum computes a generalized probability instead of a transition amplitude between final and initial. Mathematically, the formula I showed before is actually, as you can see, a mild generalization of the single path integral. It's basically a sum over amplitudes of paths, except we have two now because we're trying to get a non-negative real number rather than just a complex number. But although mathematically it's very similar to the single path integral, here I call it SPI, single path integral, there's an important difference in the emphasis, which is that usually one cares about, one asks, we start at A, we get to B, we want to know the amplitude for that or the probability. We don't ask too much about what happened in between. This is exactly the opposite. What we really care about is what happened along the way, not so much what happened at the end. And as you brought out, there's actually not necessarily an end. I mean, really, there is no final time. Or if there is, we won't be, by definition, able to ask later on what happened at that final time. So in the world, there's no final time. And so that everything that happens is really happening along the way. In other words, this sort of S matrix point of view is really not appropriate for almost all of physics. There's very important exceptions like the LHC, and it's certainly not very appropriate, I think, for quantum cosmology. I would not want to wait to get the final output of the universe. So the big difference is this. We're trying to formulate things in a way that we can ask about what happened along the way. I mentioned here weak measurements as something that you might want to compare, because they in their own way are also asking about something, what happened between the initial preparation and the final strong measurement. But there's no actual, beside that analogy, there's not actually much in common, I think, between this and weak measurements. Although I could say more about that. There is some relation, but you'll see that the scheme has nothing to do with weak couplings. So let me just finish by saying, this slide anyway, by saying that this change of focus from what happened, happened before and what happened after, to being interested in what happens along the way, I think if we hope to free quantum mechanics from external agents, wave functions, observables, and so on, which is what I'm saying is the larger program that I'm interested in, then we need, of course, we need this change of focus. Yeah.
Why do we want to free quantum mechanics from wave functions?
Oh, I think maybe you came in a little late, so I covered it in the... In the beginning. So a short answer is that I think quantum gravity needs a history's way of thinking, and the history way of thinking. And furthermore, I didn't say this, but I can say now, wave functions tend to be associated with hypersurfaces or moments of time. It's not a very covariant way of thinking. And so the needs of general covariance, we could say, lead us to history's formulation of quantum gravity. And then if we want to do quantum gravity, of course, we need the history's formulation for quantum mechanics. So I've been stressing that what the measure gives you is a number, a generalized probability associated with any event. So it's useful to think about different types of events and which ones the standard way of the sort of what I call the Luders Copenhagen paradigm for measurements and observations and so on, in which case it can deal with that, and in which kinds of histories require something new, which is the type that we'll be talking about. So let me, I've just here distinguished four different classes of histories. Singleton histories, that just means a history consisting of a single world line, singleton event consisting of a single history, that is a single world line. That you can directly, you could imagine doing a sequence of measurements, of position measurements, say, in computing, and directly reading out from the results the amplitude of that, or the squared amplitude of that history. Then there's instrumental events, which I've talked about already, and there again, almost by definition, the standard Copenhagen-Luders viewpoint, phenomenon, whatever you like to call it, deals with those adequately, as far as we know. And there's what I would call here terminal events, or maybe another name would be simultaneous events. They're closely related to the instrumental ones. What happened what the particles or whatever are doing at the end of the story, and they're closely related to records. That's another story. But again, they have to do in the end with a configuration at one moment of time. And you can imagine a projective measurement or some standard kind of measurement that could reveal their measures. However, almost no events out of all possible events, event being a set of histories, almost none of them are really of this form. What most events are what I'm calling here temporally extended events, for lack of a better name. You might call them space-time events. Maybe there's another name. But what they are is the kind of event that quantum gravity necessarily deals with. So I remind you about, for example, the horizon of a black hole. So I claim most events are of this type. So let me give an example. What's happening? Oh, there it goes. Okay. Instead of just a black hole, let me give an example. In the same spirit as the system we're dealing with, this optical system. So everyone is familiar with the two-slit diffraction experiment. And a particular event might be, and there may be a detector here, so a particular event might be that a particle is emitted from the source, goes through the slits, and arrives at the detector. And then other events might be you might block off this slit, and then you would have your event. Suppose we temporarily block this off, then the event of arriving at that detector, having gone through these slits, would then consist of just two histories, right? This would be the only way that it could arrive at that detector. So that would be an event consisting of two histories, and it would be, you could get its quantum measure just by taking the probability of arriving at the detector with this blocked off. So the kind of events that are sort of temporally extended in a non-trivial sense can be illustrated by this event. So this event is going to consist two histories, gamma 1 and gamma 2. So it's just a set of two histories. If you think about it, at least as far as I've been able to think about it, there's no way that I mean, this is a well-defined event. It consists of two histories. We can give it in words. We can say either the photon went through the upper slit in the first diaphragm and the lower slit in the second diaphragm and arrived at the detector, or it did the opposite thing. But there's no simple way that you can design, I think, an experiment to reveal the measure of this event. If someone wants to take it as a challenge, you can try and think whether there is one. But as far as I can see, there is not. And the point is that most events are of this last type. And it's these events that take quantum measure theory, by which I mean the theory of this quantum measure, beyond ordinary quantum mechanics. The quantum measure is able to ascribe measures, non-negative real numbers, to such events that ordinary quantum mechanics does not. So we can then ask, and I claim most of the interesting events for quantum gravity, among others, are of this form. So we could ask, I think you could make a similar case for quantum field theory, but I won't try to. So one could ask whether this, we should take this generalization of the classical probabilities that quantum mechanics gives us, whether we should take this generalization seriously. I mean, I would say yes, because this is the most, and people who have thought about history's formulations have always come up with this as the natural dynamical object. However, an operationalist, or even someone who's maybe not even clearly an operationalist, I have in mind, for example, some person who asked a question when I talked on something related on quantum measure theory, they will quickly say, can you give this an experimental meaning? Can you measure this? If not, it's not of any interest to me, right? That's what they'll say. Now, I would argue violently, perhaps, against that viewpoint. On the other hand, it's certainly not ridiculous to think whether this thing, which is supposed to be the new fundamental dynamical object, can be given a direct experimental meaning. If it can, that's all to the good. It helps us understand what it is, and it helps us win arguments with operationalists. Right? So, so that the main point of this talk, and here it is, that as we're just about to see, one can do this. One can, so to speak, measure the quantum measure. And we can do so without going beyond the narrow confines of the Copenhagen-Luders conception of measurement. So I had originally, when I thought about this, I thought maybe we'll have to go beyond this, and this will, we'll have to imagine new kinds of interaction and so on. Then you could get into an argument whether nature can actually realize these new types of interaction. But it turns out that one doesn't. That with staying within it, things that are absolutely standard in quantum information theory and so on, one can show how to directly measure this quantum measure. Now, the simplest, in introducing this, it's a little more didactic, I think. It makes things a little clearer if you deal first with singleton events and then events consisting of just two histories, but there's not time for that. If you see the paper that I referenced before or the lectures, the ICTS lectures, you can see that. But what I'm going to do here is try to just present the general case as clearly as I can, how one can measure, how one can design an experimental arrangement to measure or to reveal the quantum measure of any event that one chooses. So how are we going to do this? Well, as I said, everything is standard. So we're going to deal with ancillas and unitary transformations on the ancillas and so on. So the rough idea is to couple in an ancilla for each stage of the history. So each, here's one stage, here's another stage, here's another stage, and so on. So there's basically one stage for each beam splitter, and we're going to couple an ancilla for each stage. You could imagine having two ancillas to detect which beam it's in, but obviously one is enough since there's only one other beam besides the one that I've put. So that's the first stage of what we're going to do, couple in the ancilla in such a way that it'll keep track, so to speak, or copy, as I've said here, the beam in which the photon was. And so I remember I labeled the beams, the possible beam that the photon could be in by x1, x2, x3. So I'll say that it copies that x1 and so on to y1, y2, and y3. So I'll use the ancilla beam or ancilla configuration. I'll call them y's. Basically, this is like a coupling of putting a C-naught gate at each such beam, yeah? Oh, well, because I'm not going to look at the, so we'll see what we do with that. That's an important question, right? So it's not registered, it's not, you know, printing out what it found. It's just keeping it, and then we're going to perform a unitary transformation on the ancillas. So that's the important part. It's closely related to something that you may or may not be familiar with called quantum eraser, where in some sense you get information, but then you arrange to forget it. Yeah, there was another. Well, you tell me. So let me show you how it looks like in the histories formulation. you can tell me what it looks. So you mean the forgetting operation? Or
the original
copy. Oh, the original copying. It's just a C-naught gate. So in other words, this zero, together with the ready state of the ancilla, would go to zero and the zero of the ancilla, and then the one together with the ready state of the ancilla would go to a one plus the ready state of the ancilla. So this is the prototype, what's the word that I'm looking for? It's the exact interaction that people always consider when they consider a measurement in the kind of von Neumann scheme. I can write it, or but maybe it's on the next. It might be here on the next, essentially, effectively on the next slide. Was there another question?
This becomes part of history again.
So yes, you're right, exactly, yes. So we'll have two notions of history. We'll have the history of the system itself, just that photon and the beam splitters, and then we'll have the enlarged history, which will include the histories of the ancillas, and there's going to be a counter also, which you could think of as an extra ancilla. And so we'll have to, that's exactly right. So we have to, the aim is to design the larger scheme so that the probability of an event of corresponding to the larger history, in other words, the clicking of the counter is the set of all histories of the extended system in which the counter clicks, right? We want the probability of that to be directly related to the probability in the smaller system. I mean, if we ignored everything but the top line, that would be the probability of that event in the original system had it not been interfered with by the ancillas and couplings. So here, I don't know if this will answer your question. So here I've shown the original system together with the ancilla. So there's a first ancilla, a second ancilla, and so on. Each one is coupled in at one stage of the history of the smaller system. So let's look at this one. So the ancilla starts in its ready state. We could imagine it as being the zero configuration. You could imagine the ancilla. I haven't tried to actually design an optical version of this coupling, but I presume it's a standard thing to do. I mean, one could. But so the ancilla begins in its ready configuration, and then it emerges either in zero or in one. And the amplitudes are chosen so that if the particle history is in zero, then it will remain in zero. The ancilla doesn't move it around, but the ancilla will jump to its zero configuration. If the particle is in one, then the ancilla will jump to one. Is it clear, or should I write? I think this is just what's called is this not what is called a C-naught gate? Can anyone confirm? So, I mean,
yeah, this is
I think it's just a C-naught. If I write it as a formula, it just says, if I write the ancilla here and the particle here and the ancilla here, it's saying that there's some interaction is set up so that the particle goes to 0, 0. I should put here ready. It goes to 0, and 0 ready goes to, 1 ready for the particle goes to 1, 1. And I haven't told you what the others do, but just fill them in. You know, I haven't told you what, when it's not in its ready state, I haven't told you what it does, but you can fill that in with some any unitary. It doesn't matter, because we always put the ancilla in its ready configuration. So, this is essentially C naught, what's called a C naught case. So you see that the coupling doesn't, of course it will change, quote unquote, the state of the system if it's a superposition of 0 and 1, but it looks for these, I'm using the other language, it'll look for the eigenstate 0, and if the particle starts in the eigenstate 0, it remains in 0, but the ancilla registers that fact. If it starts in the eigenstate 1, it remains there, but the ancilla registers that fact. So after this interaction is over, the ancilla has a memory, or a temporary record of what the particle did. And of course, if we were to now look at what the ancilla is doing, that would be just the usual sort of measurement. And it would destroy the interference, and it would not, then there'd be no hope of getting the value of the quantum measure. So this is the scheme. So you have these ancillas, enough ancillas to record or remember the particle trajectory, and then one last ancilla, which is a counter, which starts off in a configuration I've called R for ready, and it either clicks or it doesn't click. So you could imagine it emerges in some beam or in some other beam, and that's either the top beam represents a click and the bottom beam not a click. And so I've called those U and D. And then if you like, now describe the stages of the measurement scheme. So I've more or less said it already. In stage one, the ancillas copy the system history gamma. In this stage, the counter is a complete spectator. And it's also important, and we haven't brought the counter in yet, it's also important that what happens in this stage is completely independent of the event we're interested in. All the ancillas are just copying the history gamma. In stage two, however, it crucially depends on what event. It's here we have to have in mind what event we're trying to measure the measure of, and we design the interaction appropriately. So in this stage, the ancillas interact with each other and with the counter, but in this stage, the system is, we don't touch the system ever again. And so that's this last stage here.
And you haven't described this interaction here, what it is that causes the counter.
I will now. So the next thing I will give you the interaction. And then stage three, if you like, we listen for the counter to click, or we look which beam the counter emerges in, just some trivial stage. So I won't bother. That's the usual thing in any making the result macroscopic or whatever. So the important thing is precisely how do we design the couplings in stage two where the ancillas interact with each other and with the counter to measure the measure of E. So since in this stage the particle is a spectator, I'll use a notation, a simplified notation, where I ignore I just don't represent its history. But we're dealing really with enlarged histories of the full system. Here's a notation that I will use when we do have to go back to the full system. So history will be described. A history of the full system will be described by a history of the system, the first photon, a history of the ancillas, and a history of the counter, and I'll call those gamma, lambda, and Q. So that's a full history. But in this discussion of what happens in stage two, we'll ignore this gamma and just consider these lambdas and Q. Just to confuse matters, I'll use gamma for lambda. So gamma in this stage, you'll see why, I hope. So in this stage, gamma represents an ancilla history. Okay. So what's an ancilla? So I've called gamma y1, y2, yn. So what is an ancilla history? Well, it just tells for each ancilla made a transition from its ready state to either 0 or 1, And then it's, and then when that's all done, we have these N ancillas, and they're each in the configuration given Y1, Y2, or whatever. That's the momentary configuration of the ancillas. There'll be another stage in which it'll, which I'll describe in a second, in which there'll be then both the ancillas and the counter will make transitions. And let me describe, this describes the situation at the end of the first substage of the second stage. And the counter is just sitting in its ready state, and then at the, and then when we bring it in, it will either, as we saw before, go to U, which is a click, or D down, which is silent. So here is the answer to Lucien's question. So the important, so the full story, I'd have to give you a transition amplitude from every ancilla configure, every ancilla and counter configuration to every other ancilla and counter configuration. It's not necessary to do the calculation, and it'll just, I think, make things more complicated. So I'm just give you the subset of that transition matrix, that unitary matrix, that is important. So, and that can be described by three things. So here, let's take a ancilla history gamma, which remember, which is just recording, it's remembered the history of the actual particle. That's why I've called it gamma here. So if it's not in the event that we're interested in, what happens? Well, with amplitude one, nothing happens. The ancillas stay in their same configuration, but the counter says down or no, you know, no click. So the counter will not click when the ancilla has recorded a history in the event of interest. On the other hand, if the event, so that's when gamma, the ancilla configuration, is not in E. What happens when the ancilla configuration is in E? If it does belong to E, then, and if there's a second, and if gamma prime is any other particle or ancilla history, which does belong to E, then you make a transition from gamma with the ready state, the ancilla gamma with the ready state of the counter to the ancilla gamma prime with the click or up state of the counter. So, and notice that the amplitude, which is 1 over E, is completely independent of what gamma prime is. It's here that the sort of, we're undoing the measurement because of this fact that the amplitude is independent of what gamma prime is. So it mixes up the different ancilla configurations, which are all compatible with the event E. So the counter in this case, remember, by going to U, it says, yes, the event happened, quote unquote. The amplitude is 1 over E. E, L, and E is the number of elements, I mean, the I call this the magnitude of E, that represents the number of histories in the event E. And then finally, if the ancilla history starts also corresponding to the event E, but gamma prime is something that doesn't correspond to the event E, then that transition is forbidden if the counter clicks. In other words, it's forbidden that the counter will click and the ancilla will make a transition to an event, to a configuration that belongs to the complement of E, that's not in E. So those are the important amplitudes. Now, I haven't proved to you, one can prove that these are compatible with overall unitarity. In other words, I can extend these to a complete transition matrix for the ancilla together with the ancillas, together with the counter. Yeah?
So how is it that the counter knows that it's to behave in this manner?
You mean you want me to actually design the...
The conjecture is that it's possible to design such a device.
Oh, so there's two questions. Is it mathematically possible to extend this to a unitary matrix? The second thing, is it possible to implement this in reality, this unitary transition? So it's generally thought or generally established in quantum information kind of things that any finite unitary like this can be realized by sequence of gates and you know, optical elements like this. But of course, it is a very interesting question. If this was really our system, how would we design that thing? So in the end, I'll refer you to someone who's working on that and is probably going to do the experiment in Bangalore, but I cannot give you the specific one.
Okay. Well, one more question. Is there any relationship between the readout and the counter, or to what extent do we have any information about the final state?
Exactly. So I'll come back. That's a perfect question, and I'll come back to that in the end. So for those who are not familiar with the history as language, it might be worth mentioning this, that what we're doing in another way of, in the more familiar way of talking, is we are quote-unquote measuring the projector onto the ancilla state, which is the sum of all the states lambda for lambda in E. This is also, as I said, related to the idea. The technique here is related to the concept of quantum eraser. But you don't need to know that. I've given you here all the relevant information about how the coupling, what the coupling is meant to do. I have not given you the information on how to set it up in practice. But I did claim that almost every quantum information person will say, oh yes, we know that this is possible and we can even design one for you. It may not be the most it may not be the most efficient one, but we can design it for you. So I recall the notation again, and then I want to do just finish by doing the computation and showing that the probability of the click directly reveals the quantum measure we're interested in. So now, because of this confusion between the histories of the small system and the histories of the big system, it's necessary to describe a little notation. Of course, this always comes up. If you really take seriously, if you try to include the apparatus in the description, which ultimately any successful interpretation of quantum mechanics has to be able to let you do that, then you always have a confusion between the histories and events of the subsystem and the histories and events of the bigger joint system. So anyway, I've given you the notation. So system means just the original photon, original system. The ancilla is the counter, and I've labeled them as gamma, lambda, and Q. Gamma and lambda are the same kind of thing because all the ancillas are doing is recording gamma, basically. So they're both bit strings. Q is just a single bit. It's either up or down, click or not click. And then now I have to distinguish between the measure for the big system and the measure for the original subsystem. Mu naught, I used to call it mu, now I'll just call it mu naught. And mu sub e is the measure for the whole ball of wax for the system, the ancillas, and the counter all together. And I've given it a label. I could have called it mu tilde or something, but I've given it a label e because, as I pointed out, this measure depends heavily on which event we're trying to measure, the measure of. So it all depends, it all comes in this setup. The setup depends very much on what is E. So what do we want? We want that in the big setup, the measure of C, which is the click event, that the measure of C should reveal the measure mu naught of E. And now the click event, after you listen for it anyway, is an instrument event. And so I told you, although I didn't prove it, but I told you that that measure of the click event, since it is an instrument event, is precisely the probability of the click. So another way of reading this is that the probability of the click should reveal the measure of this temporally extended event, E. Yes. Oh no, that's another very good point. Of course, we have to make the same assumption that people always make, usually not, it always worries me, but it doesn't worry anyone else, which is that we can reproduce the same physical situation over as many times as you like and take statistics and then that. So that's what it means in practice. So we have to run this many, many times and have the frequency of clicks. So that's what I mean by the probability. Okay? So what we hope is that the frequency of clicks will reveal the measure mu naught of E, of the event we're interested in.
But none of the individual clicks will tell me about the event that occurred.
They will. Let's leave that aside. That's the last thing, if I can get to it. So there's only two more slides. I think, yes, there's only two. So your questions all belong to this final slide. Let's go through the calculation. So what remains, aside from the talk at the end, although there's more than talk, there's some interesting things, but what remains for the main goal is to compute this click probability, this measure of the click event, and see how it's related to mu naught of E. So if we trace through how the history develops, I mean, if you go through all the amplitudes I gave you, which I wouldn't expect you to do in your head now, but if you go through it, you'll see that if what we're interested in is this mu E of the click, the only histories that contributed to it are such that both gamma, that is the history of the photon itself, and the record of it that the ancillas make, lambda, that they both belong to the event E, not surprisingly, perhaps, and such that the detector clicks. That's the definition of the click event, of course. The history does anything, the ancillas do anything, I mean, the particle does anything, ancillas do anything, but the detector must click. That's the event we're interested in. So the only events, histories that can belong to it certainly have a U here. And it turns out if you use those amplitudes I showed you, they only have gamma and lambda that belong to the event E. And moreover, their amplitudes, because of this way the C-naught gate works, their amplitudes are very simply related to the amplitude of the photon history gamma. It's just, in fact, the amplitude of that photon history times 1 over E. Okay. Then the rest of the calculation then becomes very simple. You have to go back, maybe I can find it, to the general formula for the quantum measure that I gave you. Here it is. So it's product of amplitude for the first history, amplitude, second history, complex conjugate, a thing that governs the interference or not interference. So if we go back to that and plug in the particular amplitudes we have in types of histories, then it's a sum over pairs. I've used capital gamma for the joint history. So it's a sum over pairs of histories. As before, the amplitude of the first, amplitude of the second, interference, controller, and each history, that resolves into a bigger sum when I resolve what these gammas are. Remember that the Q, that is the ancilla history, the counter history had to be U, so there's no sum over that, over U and D, but there's a sum over gamma and lambda, the ancilla and the photon, and it turns out to be this simple expression. It's the A naught amplitude of the photon first history times the complex conjugate of the second, both divided by E. That's this 1 over E here. Times, and then remember what this theta did. It said that the final outcome, provisionally final outcome, had to be the same. So both the photon histories had to emerge in the same beam. That's the theta naught. Has nothing to do with the ancillas. And the ancillas have to emerge also in the same state. So that's, I put delta, chronic of delta, for when the ancilla configurations are equal. And then now we can do this sum very simply, because the only place lambda and lambda prime appear are here. So I can do that sum, and it's a double sum, but it only contributes on the diagonal. So I just get E, the number of lambdas belonging to the history E. So it's just, again, this absolute V, or the cardinality of E. And that combines with one of these in the denominator, and the other one I take out in front, and the answer in the end is 1 over E times a sum, which you can now recognize precisely as the measure of the photon history, the photon event, E. So it's a sum over photon histories, pairs of photon histories. It's of the same form as this, only just for the subsystem. So in the end of the day, the probability of the click frequency, which is this, is given by mu naught over E. In other words, mu naught of E, which is what we wanted to reveal, is the click frequency times E, rescaled by E. And in this sense, so it doesn't directly give you, the click probability doesn't directly give you the measure mu naught of E. Indeed, how could it have? Because mu naught of E can, because of constructive interference, mu naught of E can sometimes exceed 1. So it's not a probability. So you have to scale it up. But in this regime, In this scheme, you scale it up by the amount E. And that introduces a certain inefficiency that means you have to do more. You still have to repeat, instead of an infinite number of times, you have to repeat it E times an infinite number of times to get the answer. Or another, less flippantly, you have to do more runs of the experiment to get a given precision on mu naught of E.
So how do we know what the norm of E is?
How do we know what which? Oh, that's just the number of events. It just represents the cardinality. E is a history, as an event, is a set of histories. You just count the histories. So the more complicated the event, the more histories it contains, the bigger E is, and somehow the lower the efficiency of this. In this, it's always a discrete set. Yeah. Then thinking about a continuum limit is obviously one would, well, that's an interesting discussion. So I think in the end of the day, you can idealize it as a limit, but that certainly requires some thoughts. Okay. No, yeah.
So your procedure was at the very end, you sort of randomize and make each computer to one over E times.
Yeah, right.
Quantum randomization. That step you could think of that as occurring after the click or no click event.
Perhaps you could reverse the order. I don't know.
But it seems like you could think of it as being afterwards, because the click event can happen, and then subsequently you can do that randomization. Just the way you described it, it seemed like that could be the case. Yeah, there. Well, go back. There.
Yeah, these ones, right. Yeah, I wanted to go back to this picture.
Okay. Do you have to do it? Do you think you have to do it at the same time, or?
Well, I thought of them as at the same time, but let's think about.
You would worry.
I don't see how. No, I don't. I mean, these are joint amplitudes that involve both. The counter does, and what the histories do. I'm not sure that it factors in the way that you're saying.
Well, couldn't you have, instead of, so your middle line there, the blue line, instead of having gamma r to gamma prime, you have gamma r to gamma u, and then have another process later, which takes you.
But then, okay, gamma prime u.
And then have another process that does that. But the only reason I'm worried is because if you could do that afterwards, it would be strange that the 1 over E was coming in.
Yeah, if you could do it afterward, then there would definitely be something strange. Yeah. Then you could say, how can that possibly influence the probability of the detector clicking? So that's why So that's why I think that you shouldn't be able to do it.
I just don't see why you can't.
Of course, it may be,
Is it a related question to ask, whether the counter click has to be detected, or is it still to be dealt with as part of a quantum system, which is what you've done to this point, so there's actually no measurement been made. And so that measurement needs to be made in order to be able to actually have a result that you can see.
That is certainly true. But if we could do what Lucien said, we could even make that measurement. And it's hard to see how it could affect operation that was done only to the ancillas. How would they know whether you measured the counter or not? So I suspect it's not possible to design it this way, but it's not something I've thought about. So yeah, we could think about it. It's conceivable also. I mean, I haven't shown you the full transition probability. The amplitudes. I've just shown you the irrelevant part. So it's conceivable that if you did what you said, you wouldn't be able to extend it to a fully unitary matrix. I'm not sure.
So if we come back to my question.
Let's come back to your question. Yes. So then we can think about this.
The question is if the requirement is that the detection is registered so that we can actually perform the calculation afterwards, how many steps would be in the history that goes from the state that you've drawn to the one where we have a registered detection that would be part of history, and many different paths could possibly be followed
Yes.
in that registering, and so that would make the whole calculation. So that, I guess it comes back to this question, you know, at what point do you need to bring in a classical environment?
Oh.
Do you keep nesting one environment inside another, getting more and more complex?
No, I don't think we ever need to go beyond listening for the counter to click. Why do you say we would?
Well, to be able to know. I mean,
oh, no. If you want, if you want to say we want to check that it's somehow experimentally that it's true that when the counter clicks, the event happens, then we would need an independent concept of what it means to check experimentally whether the event happened. I'm claiming that to a certain provisional, in a certain provisional sense, this can be interpreted as checking whether the event happened. I'll show you precisely what I'm saying.
Okay.
So that if the counter clicks, then we know provisionally, I stress provisionally, because the real answer depends on having a better story about what is the microscopic reality.
Well,
that would give meaning to whether the event really happened.
So,
but I want to give you some evidence pointing in the direction.
But when you say we know the counter is clicked, I mean, that to me is already way beyond what you've shown. You've shown conceptually that we've got something,
way beyond.
But to me that counter is still in a superposition.
Well, I never used the word superposition, but anyway, yeah, of course you could. But so I've just computed the quantum measure of the counter emerging in the upper beam, which is the click beam.
Okay.
Now you say, how do we actually experimentally determine what is that quantum measure?
Yes.
That, of course, we need. This is not an attempt to resolve the measurement problem. This is, if you like, a step along the way to resolving the measurement problem. But it's not trying to do that. But if you imagine a more traditional kind of experiment, I mean, let me sort of review the whole train of thought. The hope is that by working with the quantum measure as opposed to wave functions and POBMs and so on, that is the path to resolving the measurement problem. But I'm not claiming to do that here. What I'm trying to do is explore how much can we say about this quantum measure when we stick completely within traditional lines? Can we give it an experimental meaning? That's the question I'm asking here. But one might say, suppose you had a position detector or something, and it clicked. You might want to say that means the particle really was there. You might not want to say it, but a lot of people, it's very tempting. It's very hard to, you know, believe that it didn't mean that the particle was there. But it's possible to disbelieve it. So if you're willing to believe something like that, then here's some evidence that you might like to believe that if the detector clicks, then that event really happened. But I underline this word provisional because I think it's only the first step to a much more complicated interpretational question, which is the measurement problem, right, if you like. And when that's resolved, the story will probably be, in my guess, more complicated than what I'm showing you here. But there are nevertheless interesting indications that the answer to your question could be, in a certain sense, yes. So that's all I'm claiming here. So suppose that the counter does click. So now we have to do what people call the update, or what do they call it, update. We have to use a different dynamical, we have to change the dynamical description of the system to take that into account. So how can we do that? So here's two ways. One is the sort of Luders collapse rule, which works with wave functions and so on, and it says to project them onto the counter state U and use that. There's another one that's completely, at first sight, different, which is in use in probability theory and theory of stochastic processes, Brownian motion. And it says, okay, now when you want to compute the probabilities of future events, instead of including all the histories in that event, throw out all of those which did not belong to the event E that we know happened. That's how it would have been on classical probabilities. Now, in my opinion, we don't really know whether, of course, here we'd be using it quantum mechanically. So to talk about the future, use the same quantum measure, the same path integral and so on, but throw out all the histories gamma not in E from our history space, which I called here omega. So in my opinion, we don't know whether either rule is actually true. We know the first one works well in many situations. But here's the interesting thing, that if we treat this so-called collapsed psi as the initial amplitude for the subsequent path integral, maybe here I'll put a parenthesis, that in a path integral formulation, the only place that a wave function ever enters is kind of as an initial set of amplitudes for doing the path integral, if it enters at all. So if we treat these collapsed psi as the initial amplitudes for the subsequent path integral, then it's exact, and we compute any quantum measures, and therefore any instrument probabilities and so on, it's exactly the same as using the stochastic conditioning rule. Because, and here's the first key point, the collapsed psi for the particle is precisely what you get by evolving the initial psi for the particle, which was trivial in our example, via a restricted path integral taken over only the histories that belong to E. So you do exactly the same path integral. So now it's a single path integral. You use it as a propagator, but you only include the histories belonging to E. That'll give you the final wave function if you derive it from the collapse rule. In that sense, I want to say that this measurement was a kind of minimally disturbing detection of the event E, whatever word you like to use. I could have, of course, detected the event E in other ways that would be maximally disturbing. I could have measured the location at each stage and then seen whether or not that trajectory belonged to E. There's no way I'd get the right measure that way, and this thing in blue would not be true. So this is minimally disturbing in that sense. And there's one other thing that I can say. So let's consider another event, which is the click event and E bar, the complement of the event E. So in words, that's that the counter clicked and the event did not happen. We can compute its measure. And if you look at those, go through the computation with the amplitudes I showed you, this is the event, the complement of E. If you go through the computation, you will see that vanishes. The measure of that, the quantum measure of that vanishes. Now that is not an instrument event because it's an instrument event together with something to do with the system. But if we accept, as I think one should, that an event whose measure vanishes does not happen, and if we then reason classically, which we should not always, but if we then reason classically, say, this tells you that it can never happen that the counter clicks and the complement event happens. That would mean that if the counter clicks, then the event E happens, because it's counted, if we reason classically. So this is another sense in which the clicking, in some sense, to some extent, implies the happening of the event E. But it would require using classical logic in a situation where it's not necessarily right to use that kind of classical reasoning. So that's all I have to say. But I summarize that by saying, in this provisional sense, we can say that a click might be a minimally disturbing verification that the event E really did happen. Okay. And then, as I said, Urvashi Sinha, who many of you know, who did the three-slit experiment, one of the people doing the three-slit experiment, she has a lab in Bangalore where she's going to look at, try and take some genuinely non-trivially temporally extended event and measure its quantum measure in this way. And that'll hopefully be a new class of measurements that one can do. And what its further use would be, I don't know. But it seems, since we can do it, and since it's shedding light on this quantum measure and a history's approach, I'll be very interested to see the outcome. Thanks. Oh, yes.
Have you done that yet? It's relatively clear how to do it. But you could imagine it pretty much any path.
Yeah, you could measure it for any kind of path that's described by discrete information. You could certainly do it. I think it's basically in our paper. I just used this. This seems sort of the most down-to-earth or the nearest to experiment and maybe quite familiar, most familiar. So it doesn't have to be just two beams, you know, it could be many beams, it doesn't have to be optical. There's a nice generalization of this two-site hopper that you can call an n-site hopper that actually has a strictly unitary evolution in which we believe, although it's not still an open question, in the limit of n goes to infinity goes over to the Schrodinger evolution, in other words, to the free non-relativistic particle. So I think that's quite interesting. If you bring in a true continuous thing, you know, where the path has to be described by an infinite number of different parameters, then, of course, the this correction factor will become infinite if you think of an absolutely, if you make some sufficiently, let's say, weird event that couldn't be described by a finite number of conditions. So as long as the event can be described by a finite number of conditions, even though the histories within that are maybe an infinite in number, then I think this will go through. And so I think, I think that's probably a fair statement. Another question you can ask is that E optimum? Maybe you could do better with another arrangement. So I think one can almost prove that it's optimum, but I don't know. I mean, you know, if you could do much better, that might help with the infinite case, but I think that's very, very unlikely.
Presumably, you could also accept sort of lower fidelity on your measurement of mu in return for a finite E.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you could, right.
If you were to
approximate the
by some finite set of.
Yes, exactly. Right, I would hope that in some appropriate limit procedure you would see that you could recover any event. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Is there any other questions?